Coming up, I got 11 thoughts from the weekend in the NBA. I got some thoughts from the weekend, starting with free agency and then later summer league. Number one, the Cavaliers are increasingly becoming the LeBron James favorite, but is this to be believed? If you look at Pauly market and the prediction markets out there, Cleveland right now is at 59% to sign LeBron James. The Warriors, after becoming the favorites 1 week ago today, are down to 18%. The Heat are at 9%. And I think this makes sense, considering everything that we've been hearing, everything we've been seeing with our own eyes this past week. LeBron James has been in Cleveland. He's going to old places. He's golfing. He's doing his thing out there in Cleveland. All signs do seem to be pointing to the Cavaliers today. But a week ago, all signs were pointing to the Warriors. And we'll see how things are going to change. Of course, we talked recently about the Rich Paul whiteboard thing he did on his podcast with 10 teams on there. The Warriors weren't in the inner circle. The Cavaliers were. They got a lot of time. The Heat were as well. I just think with LeBron, it is completely understandable if he goes back to Cleveland, if it is purely for the full circle moment of his career, right? If this is what it's all about, ending where it began. But at the same time, I think if there's hopes of winning a championship, a fifth ring for LeBron, and he still, in my opinion, should still be thinking about getting that fifth ring. Who knows if he could be in a position to get that still, even though it's so late in his career at 42 years old. This Cleveland roster, I know they were in the Final Four. I know they made it to the Final Four. But they got through a Raptors team that's young with a crappy offense. It took 7 games. It took 7 games to get through the Pistons, a poorly constructed roster built only for the regular season, not for the playoffs. And then they just got completely blasted by New York with a historic blown Game 1 lead. The team quit on each other in Game 3. The coach, they won the series analytically, but the coach was really bad. Kenny Atkinson was really bad in that series, really throughout the entire postseason as well. So this Cavaliers roster for LeBron James, what's good with Mitchell and Harden is you have other ball handlers that can alleviate the workload off you. What's good is you are an upgrade over Dean Wade. Like, you're going from Dean Wade to LeBron James. Obviously, he helps the team. I'm not saying that. But I just think with Mitchell and Harden, Harden, if he returns, Rich Paul said it himself on the whiteboard thing, LeBron loved Darius Garland. Didn't really say much about James Harden. Harden doesn't move off ball. He's not as much of an off-ball player. How's that going to look with LeBron? Could there be some overlap, some friction between those two on the court? Mitchell, as much as I really like Donovan Mitchell, not much of a passer. He's not. And so I think with LeBron, there's some fit issues with those guys in the backcourt, never mind in the front court with Mobley and Allen, with neither of those guys being effective floor spacers, Allen as a non-shooter and Mobley as a shaky shooter. That team also needs a backup big. So I think the Cavs, there's a lot of appeal because it's home. But at the same time, that roster needs tweaks to it, just like a lot of these other teams do. To be fair, the Warriors need tweaks. I think you look at other teams on that board as well, like Dallas is on the board. Of course they need tweaks. A lot of those teams that were on the Rich Paul board need tweaks. But Cleveland specifically, if it's home, I would hope going home also comes with roster changes to optimize his chances of hoisting a fifth Larry O'Brien trophy. That's what I want to see. And so I think with LeBron, we assume Cleveland because it seems like people think this is going to be his final year. But I don't think we should make that assumption necessarily. LeBron could easily play 2 or 3 more years. He could go somewhere else and then have his second homecoming with Cleveland. Now, we'll see, right? Like, what happens? I feel like the longer this drags on, the more I'm thinking it's Cleveland. Like, he's not going to disappoint them again. But who knows, right? I mean, the July 8th anniversary is coming up this Wednesday of the decision that happened in 2010. Of course, his ESPN interview appearance that he did. And it would be kind of like a full circle moment for him to decide to go back to Cleveland on that date if he does it on July 8th. And I think if you're considering when is LeBron going to make his choice, today's Monday. We're recording this at 11:38 a.m. Eastern on Monday morning. The World Cup is tonight. I can't imagine he's going to want to share the spotlight with the World Cup tonight. I don't think it's going to come today. Tomorrow morning, it's all going to be about whatever happens in tonight's game with Team USA. I can't imagine it's going to happen then. But late Tuesday, Wednesday, early Thursday, maybe if it's this week, that's somewhere around the time when we could expect. But I don't know. Rich Paul said it's going to be a while. So who knows? Maybe this drags on past this week. But we'll find out whenever it happens. We'll be live here on Yahoo Sports NBA. So be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and also follow my podcast. Of course, we'll have an emergency show up ASAP after LeBron does make his decision. All right, number two thought. Draymond Green. This is just pure speculation on my part, but I think it's worth wondering if Draymond Green could follow LeBron wherever he goes. And I mean, I feel like a lot of people point to him opting out purely about Golden State having flexibility to sign LeBron, give him more money, also bring back Draymond on a discounted deal. And that might be all it is. And that if LeBron doesn't go to Golden State, Draymond re-signs in Golden State, and that's that. He teams back up with Stephen Curry and Steve Kerr, and they roll the ball out again next season with whatever roster they have. But Klay already left. Who's to say Draymond wouldn't leave either? Draymond, who he knows this business, he has talked openly about how he's understanding about how in this league anybody can be traded. He understands why the Warriors shopped him around for Giannis Antetokounmpo earlier in the year. He said he gets that. He talked about that on his podcast back in February when that was a very real possibility of the Warriors trading Draymond in a deal for Giannis. It didn't happen. But you're telling me Draymond Green is going to sign a 2 or 3 year deal with Golden State with no trade clause, and then 6 months from now, possibly be moved somewhere that he doesn't want to go because the Warriors don't want to trade Jimmy Butler. They'd rather just deal Draymond instead. I feel like there's a possibility Draymond could decide to go wherever LeBron goes. Because I think you look at a lot of the teams on that list for LeBron, a lot of them could use a Draymond Green. Like we just talked about Cleveland. Can you imagine the front court with Evan Mobley plus Jarrett Allen plus Draymond Green? The ability to play with Mobley and Draymond or Allen and Draymond, like just different lineup combinations. You could play with all three of them as well. He just adds so much to any contending team. And I just think the Warriors, if they don't get LeBron, there's no path to any more rings these next couple of years. They are not a contender. If they don't get LeBron, if they don't flip Butler to go get Anthony Davis, they're not a contender. So would Draymond really go back there just to, you know, finish it out? Possibly. That very well could be what happens. But at the same time, I don't feel like anybody's talking about Draymond leaving. And that's why I just wanted to raise that thought here. Number three, the Nuggets are open to sign and trades for Peyton Watson, according to Sam Amick over at The Athletic. Watson wants a $25+ million deal. And Amick said in his story that posted Sunday night that the Nuggets are open to matching any offer, but they're also open to sign and trades. And with the conversations I've had with executives around the league, not just about Watson, but just in general with the sign and trade stuff, it's like these restricted free agents, it's sort of a stalemate because there's not much of a market out there, as we'll talk about in a second with Jalen Duren. But there's also just the fact that some of these teams saw what the Jazz got for Walker Kessler and they're like, whoa, 2 first swaps. Sign us up. Yeah. See you later, Peyton Watson. See you later, Jalen Duren. So I think some of these teams right now are waiting to see if there's a team that goes over the top like the Lakers did with Utah to go out and get Kessler. And so for Denver, I'd imagine that's part of the appeal here. Is there anything out there for them that is more appealing than signing Peyton Watson or matching an offer sheet for him, assuming an offer sheet even comes? I think for Denver, the worst case scenario is that he just signs the qualifying offer in that 1 year from now, he can become an unrestricted free agent and he can't be traded over the next year. That's a real possibility with Peyton Watson. Would he pass up all this long-term money? Maybe not, but we do see players threaten to sign the qualifying offer. And I think that's a possibility to think about with Denver and part of the fear if he doesn't decide to do that. Because we already saw what happened this year with Peyton Watson. Once he got that hamstring injury, he basically shut it down. He didn't come back because he didn't want to ruin his market And so if he were to sign the qualifying offer, you think he's going to go full throttle this next year? I don't think so. Number four, the Jalen Duren free agent market just seems absolutely dead. There's nobody out there that has money that wants Duren. And so I think for him, he's in a position now where the Pistons are not giving him a deal that he wants, but there's also not a deal out there for him in free agency to sign and actually force the Pistons to match. And I think that kind of really cleared up after the Lakers traded for Walker Kessler. So I think for Duren, he's in a really tough spot here. And again, like I just said with Peyton Watson, he is trying to figure out, is there a team out there to sign and trade for him? Is there something out there that would work? I'm doubtful. I've said all along, ever since this stuff first started, you know, brewing about Duren possibly going somewhere else, the Sabonis for Duren stuff, I've consistently said, I think he'll be back in Detroit next year. I'll continue to say that. But ultimately for this Pistons team, I got a message on Instagram. I asked for some mailbag questions, and a guy who goes by Ravioli asked me, Detroit still hasn't addressed their second initiator problem. If it's not Hero, who else could they target? Beats me. Like, it's not, there's not much out there with the free agent market. There's not much out there that makes sense in the trade market either for Detroit. So they're in a really, really strange spot right now, because I think with Jalen Duren, like, you want to bring him back considering what he did during the regular season. You get John Collins in the front court replacing Isaiah Stewart. You did draft Abuka Okoro. Maybe he is the answer. Maybe Okoro is going to be one of the rookies who comes in and does a stellar job right away. I think the jump from Stanford to Detroit is pretty massive, and it'd be unfair to place those expectations on him. But we'll see what happens, how he looks in summer league, and how Detroit might feel about him entering his rookie year. But I think Hero does make a lot of sense, because he offers that off-ball shooting ability. He offers the on-ball creation that can help alleviate that workload off of Cade Cunningham. Hero makes a lot of sense for the Pistons. And salary-wise, he could work for them as well. But ultimately, they got to do something. Like, the Pistons got to do something. All offseason long, Pistons fans have been just on me because I criticized their GM for not making a move at the deadline. They're like, Trajan Langdon said we're going to wait till the summer. We wanted to evaluate after the postseason. Yeah, but we already knew the problems. The problems were Tobias Harris isn't very good, and you guys needed more shooting. You guys needed more creation. And Harris, with his expiring salary, was the easily upgradable spot. They didn't cash that in. And now they're in a position where Harris walked. He went to San Antonio. They traded Isaiah Stewart. They signed John Collins. They drafted Abuka Okoro. What else? What's going to happen here to actually fix the problems on the team with the shooting? Isaiah Joe alone isn't enough. Bringing back Duncan Robinson alone isn't enough. This team needs more bodies, more quality talent, and more creators. And so I'm a little worried about what the Pistons have done. But we're still early. It's only July 6th. So we'll find out what happens in the coming week or so. Number five, we did get some news this morning. Rui Hachimura has signed with the Los Angeles Clippers for 2 years, $28 million. Solid signing for them. I'm not going to go crazy here with Rui. He's a solid player, offers some scoring, can pull up a little bit, three-point shooting. Not the most impactful defender, not the most impactful passer at all, or rebounder for that matter. Rui's just solid. He's a solid player. So I think for the Clippers, it's nice to kind of steal him away from the Los Angeles Lakers. But I've never been personally the biggest Rui fan until he got to LA. I think when he got to LA and started playing with LeBron and then with Luka Doncic, his numbers just skyrocketed from three-point range. Is that because of some development that he experienced? Perhaps, maybe. That it definitely could be that. Maybe he figured out how to become a more consistent three-point shooter. I would hope that sustains with the Clippers, but at the same time, sometimes these guys that have 2-3 years where they shoot the ball well, then they fall back just to becoming super inconsistent like they were earlier in their careers and as he was in Washington. So we'll see with Rui. But for 2 years, $28 million, certainly worth the money at this point. And we'll be right back after this break. Number six, back to the Lakers here. The Lakers are focused on Jonathan Kuminga, according to the Stein line. And a lot of Lakers fans over recent days have been asking, why are we just not interested in Rui Hachimura? Why not just bring back Rui? And I think the answer to that is simply because you guys signed Mamu. Mamu kind of offers the shooting that is lost by Rui Hachimura at the four position with better size and better handling and better creation. Mamu is just straight up the better player than Rui Hachimura. And I know he's not a big name. He came off the bench for the Raptors. Not a lot of people are watching Toronto. But ultimately, I think Mamu is very clearly going to prove to be an upgrade. And as for Kuminga, I don't think he's very good. He has not proven a lot. He has not shown a lot. But ultimately, what he has shown here and there are some flashes. And in the same way Rui Hachimura was sort of a, you know, semi-buy low for the Lakers, you got Rui from Washington when he was only at the time 24 years old. Kuminga is still young, and he's coming off a rocky start of his career with the Warriors. It was a poor fit. And then he goes to the Hawks, and he was, you know, up and down. He had some moments. Maybe in L.A., playing next to Luka, he could bring him to life. And they need some athleticism in that front court as well. So I like the Lakers focusing on Kuminga, personally. I think it's a solid bet for them, especially after losing Rui and gaining Mamu as the replacement there. All right, so we got a couple mailbag questions here. One related to the Lakers from Daniel to follow up on this thought with going after Kuminga. Daniel said, with the Lakers' underwhelming offseason, has the Luka MVP and championship window passed? I think it's probably a bit premature to say that the window has passed, but I would say it is certainly shut a little bit. And that's the scary part here for Luka when you're talking about he's going to turn 28 next season. He's had some injuries in recent years, but we also saw him possibly at his peak in terms of regular season abilities and production before he got hurt to end the year this season. And so I think with Luka, it would be kind of foolish to say it's past for a player who can any day wake up and be the best player in the world. I mean, the version of Luka we saw in the middle of March was truly extraordinary. He got it anywhere he wanted on the floor. He was efficient from three-point range, knocked down from mid-range, could get to the basket. He looked spry defensively. He looked like he was in the best shape of his life. And I thought he was more impactful on the defensive end of the floor as well. So if he's able to be an even better two-way guy, in addition to constantly just putting up numbers offensively and continues becoming even more efficient offensively, you can't rule that guy out. Dragging his team to the NBA Finals. We saw him do that in Dallas before. I think the concern with the Lakers, though, is, as you said, Daniel, this underwhelming offseason. The Lakers have not had a great summer so far, but ultimately, you know, Colin Sexton and Mamu and Grimes and Kessler, maybe these guys all work out. Maybe they all look way better playing alongside Luka. And so I would not say it's past. I think that's a bit too extreme, but without a doubt, the pressure is on the Lakers. And I think adding some more guys with upside, like a Kuminga type, I mean, why not take a shot and see what happens there? Bruno on Instagram asked me, what is your first impression on the first games of this draft class? So we'll pivot here to Summer League here, and we'll stay with the Lakers. Cameron Carr. He had his debut over the weekend in the California Classic. Cameron Carr had 26-8-4, looked dominant in the same way that he did during the NBA draft combine scrimmage back in May. I thought the diversity of the ways in which he scored was everything that you could have dreamed of if you were a Lakers fan. And in the first half alone, his first shot, he had a floater from mid-range, a spot-up three, a movement three coming off a screen. He had a contested pull-up all on the first half. And then he had his big dunk attacking a closeout in the second half as well as a few more jumpers as well. Cameron Carr out of Baylor is the type of guy, you know, he's a bucket getter. You know he can offer some secondary creation. And so it's just one summer league game. And I'm not going to go crazy overreacting to any of these. It would be ridiculous to do so. But you have to like what you saw from Cameron Carr and his debut with the Lakers. And you have to feel a little bit better about what some of these guys could offer the team if they hit. And so I like Cameron Carr's first impression with the Los Angeles Lakers. Number eight here, Darren Peterson. Darren Peterson was, dude, sensational. He looked unbelievable for the Utah Jazz. I thought Darren Peterson looked like an absolute star. He looked like he had the burst that he once had at the high school level. He had 28 points on 11 for 21 from the field. He got to the rim. He hit some off-foot layups from mid-range, from three, in the clutch. Peterson just completely delivered throughout the entire game. And I know he had 8 turnovers. I'm not worried about the 8 turnovers. I thought he passed the ball well overall, distributed as a secondary guy. But ultimately, the clutch shot making down the stretch of the game, I mean, like, it's just, it's not often. This is why I, in the end, I ended up Boozer 1, Peterson 2, DiBonsa 3. I moved Peterson ahead of DiBonsa the final week, is because there's just a fluidity that Peterson has to his game, an ease in which he plays with. And I thought that was so clear at the high school level. When you just put that on synergy and you watch all of his high school stuff, it's just such a cliche, but it's the truth. It just flows like water. It just looks easy for him, natural. And at Kansas, it didn't look like that. But I think in the Utah Summer League, at least through the one game, it looked like the high school Darren Peterson. And so I'm very excited about what he's going to do moving forward in Summer League. And I can't wait for Thursday. Peterson versus DiBonsa. I'm going to grab my tickets on the Game Time app to go to that Summer League game on Thursday. I cannot wait. I hope those guys are both playing, and I hope they're both playing at a high level. I hope they're both playing heavy minutes, because it seems like anytime AJ and DP go against that each other, it's theater. I think those guys could become a real rivalry in the NBA, and I hope Thursday night in Las Vegas, Darren Peterson versus AJ DiBonsa is the first sign of that happening in the NBA. All right, number 9 thought from the weekend here. Cameron Boozer, his summer league debut with the Memphis Grizzlies. He will play Friday against Caleb Wilson as well over out there in Vegas if you're heading out. Boozer in his debut for the Grizzlies had 15-4-4, and he looked like Cam Boozer. I don't know what else there is to say. He's directing his teammates. He's pointing around like, hey, pass it there. Screen here. Like, he just looked like a 35-year-old veteran out there. And what impressed me most, I thought, in the game was the return of his mid-range jumper. He didn't take a lot of them last year at Duke. It's not really part of their analytics-happy offense. But he pulled out a turnaround mid-ranger in the first half. He had a baseline pull-up in the second half. So in addition to the quality passing, in addition to the three he hit and the interior finishing, the patience he showed, the mid-range making a bit of a return for Boozer is just an intriguing thing to monitor with him, because I think with Boozer, so often people act like, oh, he's just a role player. Boozer is a do-it-all stud on the offensive end of the floor. And if the mid-range is there, it changes, I think, the complexion of what's possible for him on the offensive end, because we know how important the mid-range is to star-level talents. Additionally, the Memphis Grizzlies made a pretty savvy signing. They signed Quentin Post to a 3-year, $30 million offer sheet. Post has spent the first 2 years of his NBA career with the Golden State Warriors. He was okay as a rookie, shot well from three, but struggled defensively. And then year two with Golden State, he was a bit better defensively, and he struggled from three. But I was bullish on Quentin Post. If you remember my draft guide in 2024, I had him like top 40, top 45, or something like that. He ended up going undrafted to the Warriors. No, I'm sorry. He got drafted in the 50s, if I remember correctly. He did end up getting drafted 52nd to Golden State, but he fell a little bit. And ultimately, Post has been a rotation guy for 2 years under Steve Kerr. That's saying something. And so I think Kerr definitely has some trust in Post. And I think for the Warriors, they are suddenly in a tough spot because of this offer sheet. Because if Post is at $10 million annually, it's going to be really, really hard for Golden State to match that offer sheet and stay under the second apron. So with Golden State waiting on LeBron, waiting on clarity with Draymond, waiting on basically what's going to dictate what their team looks like next season, this Post offer sheet puts them really under a lot of pressure over the next 72 hours. And for Memphis, I think it's a smart move. Zach Edey is the guy in Memphis at the five, but he does have some durability concerns. If you have Quentin Post as a backup behind him, as a guy who can play with Boozer, to me, I think it's a really, really smart signing for Memphis if they end up getting him. Speaking of the Warriors, Jaxel Lendenborg. Oh my goodness. Like, he looks so good for Golden State. 19 points in his first game, 11 points in his second game, just basically 100% from three. He has not missed from 3-point range so far for Golden State. I've been impressed by Jaxel. I think he's showing exactly what you want to see from this guy. He's a good quote or a bad quote. Maybe if you're Steve Kerr, that's how you might feel. But I think with Post possibly leaving, this front court could be completely reshaped. And Jaxel Lindenborg at 6'9", 250 pounds, he's not going to play five necessarily. But in a pinch, as we saw at Michigan, he can play a little bit of small five for you. And so I think with him, with his three-point shooting ability, his handling ability, you're going to see Steve Kerr use him as a hub sometimes. Imagine him with Stephen Curry, two-man actions, operating out of the post or operating out of the elbow and wing areas with his ability to score. He can drive on guys. He can turn around and hit threes. He can pull up a little bit. Jaxel is just so versatile as a player on the offensive end of the floor. That's how Michigan used him last year in different roles, depending on different situations. And already I think we're seeing little glimmers of that with Golden State. So we'll see how that continues for him in summer league. He still needs to get better defensively. I thought he really struggled. We'll see if that continues to improve. But that's what stood out to me in summer league. One other thing that's interesting from this past week was the NBA released their NBA Cup groups on like Wednesday or Thursday, like during the World Cup. And it's like, huh, this is suspicious timing. Like, why would they drop this now? We don't know the schedule yet. It's just a little silly they would drop this now. And it made me think over the weekend of my interview with Evan Wash. Evan Wash works for the NBA. He basically is one of the lead creators of the NBA Cup, one of the guys who is one of the creators with the NBA draft lottery reform as well. And towards the end of our conversation during the NBA Finals, we talked about the Cup, how the Knicks and Spurs was the first rematch of the NBA Cup. And I asked Evan about potential expansion of the Cup. And what he said to me is, could we bring in the champions of other leagues around the world? Could we have, for example, the EuroLeague champion and the CBA champion join and have a 32-team Cup? The challenge, of course, is what we end up creating was built into the regular season schedule. So it gets a little complex, but it could change. As we look at expansion, as we look at NBA Europe, there's tremendous opportunity. As we look at expansion, as we look at NBA Europe, there's tremendous opportunity to build out things like the Cup and create new properties that will add more and more meaning to the calendar. And watching the World Cup this weekend, there is no replicating country versus country in basketball. USA is just far too dominant, and soccer is more of a global sport today than basketball is. However, if you're having Real Madrid play the Detroit Pistons and you're having these overseas teams from different leagues and different countries facing off against each other when they ordinarily might not, and they're facing off against NBA teams with a lot of former NBA guys who have gone overseas and played, I think once every 4 years, the NBA could definitely have the NBA Cup Global Edition, where you have teams from around the world playing like a 64-team tournament with a group stage and this and that. I think that would be pretty awesome if the league were to do something like that. And it's just the thought that's crossed my mind naturally after watching the World Cup, because the World Cup is awesome. It's every 4 years. It's not every year. It's every 4 years. So every time it happens, it feels incredibly important. And so I think for the NBA, as they build out NBA Europe, we should find out over the next couple of months who's going to own those teams. That's going to really help dictate, is there former NBA owners that are going to buy overseas? Are players going to be able to own teams or own equity in teams? There's a lot of questions lingering about how the NBA Europe is going to look, what contracts are going to look like overseas. Could it be enough for certain NBA players to jump over and play in Europe rather than playing on a middling contract here? What's a max look like overseas? A lot of questions there, but ultimately, I think for the NBA, they clearly want to grow globally. And I think with the NBA Cup, that is one of the paths towards continuing to do that. And just on my mind, watching the World Cup, it's been a lot of fun the last couple of days. So I'm tagging along late with the World Cup. I'm very late here. I wasn't watching much of it during the first two rounds, but USA versus Belgium tonight. Can't wait. Go Team USA. Hopefully we get a good game. I'm very excited for it. And hopefully we get another game on Friday as well if USA wins tonight. And I do wonder how much the World Cup is going to dictate when LeBron makes his decision. The decision 2.0. We'll see what happens with that. But I would imagine LeBron doesn't want to share the spotlight with Team USA if they win. So maybe that means Wednesday, July 8th, an anniversary decision for LeBron James could be coming. We'll see about that. All right, we'll be back later on in the week with more to talk about, I'm sure, throughout the NBA, whether we get some big signings or little signings. I'll be there at Summer League in Las Vegas doing some interviews as well. But hey, this was fun today. We'll have an emergency show whenever LeBron signs, if he signs, or if any other big trades happen as well that come out of nowhere. But that's all for today. Thank you to Emmy and the whole team for producing today's episode. Be sure to check out the Game Time app to go out and get your tickets. Thanks for giving us a listen. Talk to you later.